From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Guardians are supposed to protect seniors too vulnerable to care for themselves, but some are gaming the system with unlimited power and bad intentions, taking seniors out of their homes, selling their possessions, emptying their bank accounts, keeping family members in the dark. The New Yorker magazine took a deep dive and found disturbing stories. The writer is with us this hour on Point, The Dark Side of Guardianship. You can join us on air or online. Has exploitative guardianship happened to you, someone you know? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me this hour from New York City is Rachel Aviv, staff writer for The New Yorker. She wrote How the Elderly Lose Their Rights for the October 9th issue of the magazine. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Rachel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Your story was quite eye-opening, to say the least. Start us off here and tell us, in best-case scenarios, what are guardians for?
When a person is unable to manage their own affairs, either because they have a mental impairment or because they're so old that they've, they have dementia or they've sort of lost their insight into sort of how to live in society, then a guardian comes in and takes over their decisions. So one scholar described this as the ward becomes essentially a legal ghost because their decisions are outsourced to another person.
Right. And it's important to understand that guardians are entrusted with everything, right? From healthcare to finances.
If a guardian has, there are some guardians who control only finances, but when a guardian has complete control, yes, it's every decision from who the person associates with to where the person lives to whether the person's belongings are sold to what medications they take, every decision.
You found guardians who have almost unchecked power and have really ruined people's lives. How would you describe what's happening?
I mean, it was what felt so complicated and troubling was that what they were doing was legal, and yet it seemed so much like theft. So they would essentially take people out of their homes, put them in a living facility, and sell their belongings, often sell their houses. And as you would expect, these people's health condition would deteriorate. But because they had a court order allowing them to do this, it was legal.
So they have a court order, which means they can circumvent family members. They can take someone's rights away from them and really from the people they love and trust the most.
Right. The family members were often sidelined. And in some cases, the guardian would decide that the family member was agitating the ward, and for that reason would say the family member cannot even see the ward, or the family member could only see the ward but with these supervised visits. So it's almost like the family members would be babysat while they saw their parent or their loved one.
And so when someone loses their rights to guardianship, is there any redress for them?
I mean, I think in general, usually when someone comes under guardianship, they don't get out. There was a study by the American Bar Association this year that said, you know, there are not statistics about this. There's very little documentation of how these guardianship cases, the outcomes of the cases. But the study showed that we have no idea how many people fall under guardianship when they don't need it and then can't get out of it when they're competent again.
In your piece, you write about Rudy and Rennie North. In the fall of 2013, a private guardian named April Parks came knocking at the door of these Las Vegas residents, Rudy and Rennie, saying that she had a court order authorizing her to remove them from their home. Here is Rudy speaking with Al Jazeera America's America Tonight in 2016.
She never said it was anything other than we have three choices. One, I can call the police. Two, I can put you in a psychiatric ward. Three, you can go to a assisted living facility.
So what is so striking about this story?
What happened was the Rudy and Rennie North did not even know that they'd become wards of the court. April Parks had petitioned the court through an ex parte order, which essentially provides an exception to the rule that both parties must be notified of any argument before a judge. So when April Parks came to their home, they were already wards of the court and they didn't know it. And at that point, April Parks was right. Legally, she had the right to take them away, and they were completely disoriented and confused and humiliated, and they followed her orders. Even though Rudy North, as you can hear in that clip, is really sharp. I mean, he reads Freud, he reads Plato. He's a smart guy who can take care of himself.
No mental impairment. They're living alone. They've been married 50-something years and doing quite well, right?
Right. I mean, his daughter thought, you know, maybe they needed a few hours of help each day, but certainly they were still able to live alone at that point.
Let me bring in Julie Belshi. She is Rudy and Rennie North's daughter. She's in Las Vegas. Rudy and Rennie have since had their rights restored, and they now live with Julie. Julie, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell me what happened to your parents. It sounds like an absolute nightmare. This started over Labor Day weekend?
Correct. It was over Labor Day weekend in 2013, and I had plans to go and see my parents that day. I spoke with my mother every day and my father, and I had been calling them and calling them, and there was no answer. So I got in my car and went out to the house. And when I went out to the house, the newspaper was in the front, and I know their daily routine. They get up in the morning, and my dad goes and gets the paper, and they start breakfast. They open up the kitchen window, and they open up the other kitchen window where the table is, where they sit to have breakfast. The house was closed like a tin drum. Just everything was suspect.
And so what did you think had happened? Where did you think they'd gone?
I had not a clue. My first instinct in my gut told me that they have been kidnapped. And because my mom was normally always home, my dad would go out and run errands. My mom at the time was in a wheelchair, and now she is walking, and she has lost her 60 pounds. They had her in the facility so over-medicated she could barely open her eyes.
So 4 days went by before you found out where they were, right? How did you know that they'd been taken to some facility somewhere by a guardian who had been assigned to your parents?
I found that out after driving out there, and then I kept contact with the landlord. And the landlord, I said, please watch, you know, and see if they're there and let me know. And I had reached out to a couple of hospitals. I thought they had gotten into an accident. I didn't know what to think. I found out finally on Tuesday, the first business day after Labor Day, that what happened was there was a sign up there, and it said, in case of emergency, contact NCG/April Parks.
Who was their guardian?
Her phone number.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know what this was because I knew as a parent, I'm a guardian of children, but I didn't know that there was this whole guardianship industry where people could walk into people's house, violate their constitutional and civil rights, and take them and not notify their next of kin.
Let me play your dad here. Here he is, Rudy North, on Al Jazeera's America Today in 2016, talking about the confusion he felt when he became a ward of the state, unbeknownst to him.
I felt this would just blow over. I didn't have any idea what was going on. None whatsoever.
So, Julie, your parents were taken to this facility, taken out of their home. And in fact, this guardian, April Parks, sold most of what your parents owned. Is that right?
That's correct.
And
she kept telling them, "Oh, your belongings are safe. Where they're in storage, and and I had gone to see several attorneys, and pretty much stayed on the computer day and night, never got any sleep, and I started to understand what they are doing. You know, it's like a guardianship manual, basically.
So, Rachel Aviv, jump back in here and help us understand, was this legal, what was happening to these two people?
I mean, technically, yes, because the court had approved each step of the process. But what I found so troubling was, if you look, so two doctors had signed certificates saying that Rudy... a doctor had signed a certificate saying that Rudy North was incompetent. But this doctor, there was no mental evaluation of Rudy North. He just said that he seemed to be deteriorating. And it was like, just a brief, vague paragraph. And on that basis, he lost all his constitutional rights. But it was legal because the court approved it.
Do guardianships exist in every state, Rachel?
Yeah, they do. And the laws vary widely from state to state. But it does seem that there are these pockets around the country where, because of the lack of oversight and because of the lack of regulation, there is a lot of corruption.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onpoint. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about guardianship and when it goes wrong, what happens when a court-appointed guardian abuses unchecked power over the elderly. You can join the conversation. When is guardianship necessary, even a saving grace? Guardians, social workers, what do you see on the ground out there? Have you ever been a ward of the state and felt helpless? With me this hour, Rachel Aviv, staff writer for The New Yorker, and Julie Belshi, the daughter of a Las Vegas couple who fell under guardianship and lost nearly everything they owned when a private guardian stepped in, unbeknownst to her, and took control. I want to play some sound here. Here is a KTNV Action News report from this past spring when April Parks, who's the court-appointed guardian who took Rudy and Rennie North from their home, sold most of what they owned, when she appeared in court for the abuse she committed as a private guardian in Las Vegas. Here's the story that this investigative news team from KTNV broke, that Parks was abusing her wards in 2015.
April Parks faces more than 200 felony charges, including racketeering, exploitation, and perjury. According to court documents, she's also charged with stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from the clients she was supposed to protect. But Parks will be appointed a public defender because she claims she can't afford an attorney. Parks pled not guilty today in front of several victim family members who say that Parks isolated their loved ones.
And here April Parks spoke with the investigative news team from KTNV to talk about complaints that had been raised against her by wards and their families. Here she was expressing sympathy with the people who resisted coming under her guardianship.
When I get to that age and somebody tries to put me under a guardianship, I'm probably going to come out kicking and screaming, too.
Should note that about a year after that interview, Parks was indicted for perjury and theft, among other charges. Her husband, office manager, and lawyer were also indicted. Julie Belshi, you've been through this really incredible experience. Just tell me how your parents are doing now, how this has impacted them physically, emotionally.
My parents are doing better physically because when they were in the assisted living facility, they had them on anywhere from 10 to 15 pills.
Which they were not on before.
They were on I'm maybe like 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. So when I went to see them, it was like, you know, they were Stockholm Syndrome. They were scared, and they still are to some degree. Physically, they're doing better. It takes a while. You know, they go for walks now. They go to the library. You know, they're reacclimating to becoming part of society, because this isolates not only my mom and dad, but our whole family. Because I fought this. I have been fighting this for 4 years, and I did this by myself. I could not find an attorney that would touch this with a 10-foot pole.
Gosh. And so what would you tell other elderly people and their families about the guardianship program? What is your warning?
My warning is that to stay very close to your elderly, stay close to your family. Your little family squabbles are not important in the least bit. Always make sure you check on them, and also get your paperwork correct. Get your, you know, get your power of attorney, get a living will. And we're also going to be coming out with a guardianship nomination form, so that when, if you were checked into the hospital and you had hit your head, that will be kept in the secretary, the state box. And
to keep everything straight. Yeah. Julie Belshi, I am so grateful that you would come on, and please give our best to your parents and good luck to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Aviv, is it possible to simply refuse a guardianship? Is there any way to circumvent the initial intervention? I mean, was there any way that the Norths could have changed their outcome?
At the point at which April Parks came to their house, they were already wards of the court. And I think one of the problems generally is that many wards don't have a lawyer. So they're already vulnerable. They are probably, you know, maybe they have some impairments. They come into a legal context in which they just don't understand what is happening. And it's an adversarial court in which the guardian is represented by an experienced lawyer, and here we have this vulnerable ward who doesn't have a lawyer. And so I think what the Norths would have had to do in that moment is have the resources to find a lawyer, but that's just
that they didn't have, and many people don't have, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me get Cheryl in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you that your guest was not alone. My mother is a ward of New York. Okay. She lived in the Bronx for most of her life. In 2014, my dad had a heart attack. Okay. And he moved to California. My mother refused to move. And that was really the beginning of the end there. And, so my sister, who was, had essentially guardianship of my dad at the time.
Mm-hmm.
She tried to get guardianship of my mother. And regardless of what, I mean, my mother was suffering from dementia, and she said some crazy stuff.
And a guardian stepped in, right? How did it go?
Well, basically terrible. I mean, it's a racket. My mother had a house. She had over 42 years they lived in that house.
Mm-hmm.
And because she was in her home, they, you know, essentially were supposed to be taking care of the house. And they let the house be broken into 3 times, never called the cops once.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of stuff got stolen. And then we had insurance on the house, which they eventually started paying. Okay, we were paying the insurance, and they finally took over and never paid me back, by the way. But anyway,
I hear this a lot, Cheryl. Thank you for giving us your scenario. I know it's difficult. Rachel Aviv, I mean, you hear these stories, and you wrote about them in your New Yorker piece, selling every, you know, possession that they have, taking over the home, selling the home. I mean, the lists go on, and this is not just for the Norths. This is extensive, right?
Right. It's, I mean, I think the reason that it is allowed to happen is because there's no, in certain jurisdictions, there's just no supervision. And so it seems, at least in Clark County, the judge would essentially approve any petition that came before him. And he had very friendly relationships with the guardians because he saw them so frequently in his courtroom that he was just inclined to believe whatever they said. Mm. And they almost didn't have to provide evidence.
Here's another example of this. Elizabeth Indig's mother lost her home to foreclosure after she became the ward of a guardian. She spoke to KTNV in Las Vegas to talk about the consequences of guardianship for her family.
My mom is now sentenced to a life in a nursing home when we had a trust and we had made plans to keep her in her own home with all of her things until she died.
And here she is talking about the ordeal that she went through with her family when her mother fell under this guardianship.
They were auctioning off her clothes, even a bra that still had a price tag on it, her nightgowns, her shoes. My mom is not dead. You're auctioning off all her clothes? Really? It just seems to me they just come in and use the ward like their personal ATM. Mm.
Let me bring in now from Blacksburg, Virginia, Pamela Teester, director of the Center for Gerontology at Virginia Tech. She's an expert on guardianship and has twice been a volunteer guardian herself. Pam, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Well, so these stories are difficult to hear. Shed some light on this for us and clarify the process. Who exactly can be a court guardian?
Jane, anyone depending on the state could be a guardian. Unfortunately, in some states, and Nevada was one of them at one time, if you had a valid driver's license, you could have been a guardian. But most people who are guardians are caring and loving family members who want to help someone who cannot make decisions about themselves, their property, or both. And that's the bulk of the people who serve as guardians. Others would be volunteers, like you characterized me having done that, mm-hmm. As well as paid professional guardians. And these are the ones, I think, the stories that Rachel has written about. And then public guardians, who are the last resort function of the state for individuals who have virtually no one.
So the guardianship system is solely rooted in a relationship of trust, right? It has to be. So why is this system so inherently ripe for abuse?
The system, as a matter of fact, works fairly well in most instances, but where there are pockets of corruption, the loss of liberty is significant. Where there are pockets of corruption, people have lost their rights, they cannot contract, so getting out of the guardianship is difficult, though we do have restoration, and we learned that from the American Bar Association study. So what you have in certain places, and unfortunately some of the ones that Rachel reported on are those, where there is a corrupt system. There are systems of oversight that are in place and do a good job generally, but when they go awry, they go very awry.
Let me get Lindsay in here from Taylorsville, Illinois. Hi, Lindsay. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the public guardian of Christian County, Illinois, so I guess I'm the last resort based on what the last caller said. And I think she did a good job explaining it. In Illinois, it's much more difficult to get a guardianship, and the ward is entitled to a guardian ad litem, an attorney. And if that attorney doesn't agree with the ward, then another attorney is hired. So there's a lot of protections in Illinois, but perhaps not in Nevada.
What have you seen on the front lines, Lindsay? What have you experienced? Have you seen this?
Well, mostly, I'm as a public guardian, I get the last resort when the family members can't agree, when there's no family members. And so I go in and I have to take control of things. I don't have any choice. I have to get a letter from a doctor first that says it's incompetent, which are hard to get because doctors don't like to be sued. And also I have $1 million bond that I have to pay for on top of that because I don't want to be sued. There's a lot of protection in the public guardian level. We don't have private guardians in Illinois, much that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Just always family members.
Very state by state. Lindsay, thank you so much. Let's get Barbara in here from Endwell, New York. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I found out about the complete exploitation of my sister and her husband of 44 years when my sister died in an assisted living place. They had taken her husband, who had been the concertmaster of the Tucson Symphony and professor emeritus of violin at University of Arizona, for, 20 years. And his nephew had, I found out in Hines postmortem that his nephew had declared bankruptcy and gotten divorced and was 50-ish and broke. And I think he saw this opportunity. He took the her husband away, and he got the Nogales court to be guardian of my sister.
Yeah, yeah.
And legally, they're supposed to take care of their place and mm-hmm. get them, mm-hmm. you know, healthy and mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Did they?
No. He refused to pay the mortgage. It went into whatever you call it.
Probate.
Yeah. And he would not maintain the place. They did. Carol didn't have water at one point. My mom paid to have that fixed.
Another scenario that doesn't sound like a good ending. Barbara, thank you very much for the call there from New York. Rachel Aviv, Barbara talked there about death in the facility. And, you know, I know that you've reported on that as well. There was a couple of circumstances in Nevada where Rudy and Rennie were taken that had suspicious circumstances. Is that fair to say?
Are you asking if there were people dying at the facility?
Mm-hmm.
The facility that they were taken was a facility where April Parks brought many of her wards. There were 10 at the time that they were there, and at least 3 died in a short period of time.
Jesus.
And when I was reviewing the court records, I was struck by, I could almost see the deterioration of the ward as they lost their autonomy, because April Parks kept very detailed invoices about what they were going through at that time. And one trend I noticed was at the beginning, the ward would be called paranoid for thinking that people were against the ward, even though that paranoia was well earned. And then over time, they would get more medication. They'd become sleepier. I one thing I've been thinking about as I've been listening to people talk is that I felt that really troubled by the role that doctors and social workers were playing in this system. I think that there are times when doctors or medical professionals, rather than communicating with a patient who might be difficult to communicate with because of mild dementia or whatever it is, you know, the patient's not taking the medication, the patient isn't paying his or her bills, it becomes easier for a doctor to have a third party, which is a guardian, to make those decisions. So often doctors do sign these certificates because it's easier for them. And I think that was really troubling. The doctors weren't working to communicate with their patients, but were preferring to just have this professional handle interactions.
That's a really interesting point. Pam Teaster, what do you make of that, the role of doctors and social workers in this process?
I think that Rachel raises some really important points. Again, it varies. And you can see that when people don't take this seriously, significant rights are taken away. When people don't pay attention to older adults and what they have to say, those are ageist practices, and nobody could condone that. So it varies. But when it's bad, it's very bad.
Rachel, you talk about kickbacks in this process as well, and how that perpetuates corruption in the system. Nothing you can prove, but something that you sort of sensed. Is that fair?
I don't have evidence of kickbacks, although I heard a lot of rumors about that. But what I saw was this kind of mutually beneficial relationship between the person referring the guardian and the guardian. So one case that I found illustrative was there was a woman who had $700,000 and no children, and she wasn't paying her bills. So a social worker referred her to a guardian. The music's going on. Should I wait?
Yeah, hold that thought. We'll pick it up after the break. Rachel Aviv and Pam Teaster were discussing exploitative guardianship this hour, when people trusted by the state to help vulnerable adults abuse their power. More after this break, including your calls. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about guardianships gone wrong, when guardians take over the lives of the elderly for personal gain. And you can join the conversation. As baby boomers age, is more of this coming? What needs to be done to stop the abuse? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Rachel Aviv, staff writer for The New Yorker, who opened our eyes to the underreported problem for the elderly, and with Pam Teaster, director of the Center for Gerontology at Virginia Tech. All right, Rachel, continue the story you started before the break. The case of this woman, $700,000 in assets, no kids, guardianship was assumed. What happened to her?
Well, she was, so the first doctor that the guardian tried, that the guardian asked a doctor, will you sign a certificate of incompetence for this patient? And the doctor said, no, she's competent. And the guardian wrote an email to her lawyer saying, this is a quote, the doctor is not playing ball. And then very quickly after, the guardian found a doctor who would sign this certificate. And this woman, she was 79 years old. She actually just went to court and said, I don't need guardianship. I want to go home. And the judge said, well, I see records that you're not eating well. She said, I've been eating the same way for 20 years. He still gave her guardianship. And as far as I know from the court record, this was 5 years ago, and I think she's still under guardianship.
Pam Teaster, how do these predatory guardians find their victims?
There's a system of collusion in some places where individuals get guardianships all too easily. I would be one of the advocates, and I am with a number of colleagues, that the system ought to be more adversarial than less adversarial. And you can see the danger when it isn't. The protections in place, there are lots of them to try to make everything good, but you can sort of see the chain of the problem. When the experts don't take it seriously, when it's all too easy for someone to declare somebody incapacitated, and on the other end, when there are reports that are required by law for every guardian to do, when those are not read, followed up, taken seriously, that's when the whole thing breaks down.
So, Rachel, Pam describes the system of collusion. From your reporting, who initiated the guardianship before the court, generally? On what basis?
I'm sorry,
who generally initiated the guardianship in front of the court, and on what basis?
The guardian. I mean, are you asking, the guardian is the one who petitions for guardianship and saying often that there's some sort of medical emergency that requires immediate intervention. But I'm not sure if I was answering your
question. And so the system of collusion that Pam talks about is mm-hmm. after that happens, and then everybody sort of gets together and decides that this needs to take place. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Pam was saying about this, the lack of an adversarial system, there's just no other side often that is presented in court. It's just the guardian side and the lawyer for the guardian.
Let's get Mary.
Who is, by the way, charging the estate of the ward for the lawyer's time.
Let's get Mary in here from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I actually was a public guardian at one point as a social worker in a southern state, which I will not name. We had a pilot project through the state to take on case management of, quote unquote, I hated using that word, wards, of people that had either no family or the family had been deemed exploitive of the person. And prior to that, actually APS, Adult Protective Services, was doing the case management for the person or the ward of the state. APS does not function to be a guardian. They are there to investigate allegations of abuse, neglect, or exploitation. Mm-hmm. These people that I worked with, actually, even as a public guardian, needed significant things to be done, and I worked my tail off to make sure they happened, like mammograms, colonoscopies, regular checkups, even having state ID. One of the people I worked with didn't even have state ID, so I had to like go through that process to even get them to be seen by a doctor. Right after the financial crash in 2008, the money was immediately pulled and the pilot project dropped. I don't know what the situation is in that state any longer. I don't live there. But the big thing is, what I'm hearing is I had to go through training. I had to go through ethics training. I had to do a lot of legwork to actually be a public guardian, and the money's not there. Hmm. That's the problem to me. There's no checks and balances for these
in the system.
Guardians.
Yeah, Mary, thank you very much. Pam Teester, to Mary's point, and to sort of continue that thread, you talk about the ethics of this. I mean, guardians are supposed to file annual financial reports as required by law, but often that does not happen.
Sometimes that does not happen. Most, in fact, do. But the issue is, even not all of them always get read. So if you write something and no one looks at it or no one takes action on it, that creates a problem. And Mary is exactly right. In many, many states and most states, the public guardians are doing a fabulous job because their issue, their work is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. These are people.
Indeed.
So at the sort of the most difficult of the clients that are ever served. But the system of lots of guardians, particularly publics, are not funded well enough, and they have to do lots of training.
Here's Mark in Danville, Kentucky. Hi, Mark. Glad you waited, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention I'm an attorney in Kentucky, and I've done a few of these on the defense side, defending the ward. Actually, in Kentucky, we appoint a guardian ad litem attorney for any potential ward of the state. And we also, I heard some of your guests talking about how the guardian tries to pick doctors and things like that. We have independent medical examinations. They have to have a doctor, a psychiatrist, and a social worker examine them, and then they get a trial by jury of six jurors.
Hmm.
So it is a pretty adversarial situation in Kentucky, and it's just striking how different some of these other states seem to be handling.
Glad to hear your perspective, Mark. Thank you. Let's get Mike in here from Boston. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
My mother is a private guardian in New Hampshire. I'm an attorney, and she often consults me about her guardianship practice. And what I've been hearing doesn't really comport at all with what occurs in her practice.
Okay.
In her practice, the petitioner is typically either a medical facility, sometimes a psychiatric facility, that files a petition to appoint a guardian because the person is unable to take care of themselves. The preference is to find a close family member to serve as a guardian. When it comes to my mother is where there's either no family member who's willing or able to do it, and then she gets appointed in an adversarial hearing process where there's an attorney that represents the ward. She cares for them either physically with respect to their person or over their finances sometimes when they don't have the capacity to do that. And she has to file her reports with the court. Every bill that she would submit for her services has to be approved by the court. So I think what we're hearing with respect to some states doesn't match up with the good practices that exist in various others.
States. Right. Mike, thank you very much for the call. Rachel, Aviv, I mean, to Mike's point, are there pockets of abuse that you found, perhaps in places where there is a high elderly population or some other reason?
Yeah, it seemed to be places where elderly people tend to retire. And I agree with what he's saying that there are, I mean, I've also heard stories about family members who are frustrated because it's too hard to get guardianship over a loved one. So I think generally it's just a field of law that is not sort of coherent or consistent or regulated. So it can go in either direction. In Las Vegas, I think it was just so bad that I would say that it was criminal, but it was operating with the approval of the courts, and it had been going on since the 80s. So this is 30 years of people who were sort of deprived of autonomy and of contact with family, usually in the final years of their lives.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. Pam Teester, guardianship is still controlled state by state, right? Not by federal law. Is that correct?
Yes, Mary. It's a creature of each state has different state laws, and what you're hearing is a reflection of how those particular state laws function. Kentucky, by the way, has a really nice system, a nice adversarial system, but it is the only state in the country that has a jury trial.
Hmm. And one of the reasons this abuse may happen is that there are no statistics, right? No hard data about how many, how much this is going on. No exploitative guardianship data out there that states keep track of.
There's very little of that, Jane. The caller, Mary, who talked about Adult Protective Services, that would be where I usually go to try to understand the problem. But really, what is really egregious is that there are no data. No one state at all knows how many people are under guardianship in it.
That's incredible, Rachel. No state knows.
Right. Yeah, I mean, even in Nevada, it seemed to be, so in Clark County, there were up to 9,000 people who were technically under guardianship, but when the courts started looking more closely, it appeared that many of them had already died. It just, the records were not even kept up to date.
Let's get Joelle in here from Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Joelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've been on both sides, actually. I was a guardian for Lutheran Services, which has that in Florida, the potential ward is usually referred by Adult Services because they're in some sort of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get appointed an attorney to represent them, and Lutheran Services had an attorney if we thought that they needed someone in their best interest. And we would always try to find, we would turn over every stone to try to find a family member willing to do it. And a lot of our wards were indigent and didn't have a whole lot of money left. I think what I've seen in that scenario was a lot of caring people looking to take good care of these folks who usually were in pretty rough shape. Some of them have psychiatric issues as well, but they always had representation. And you didn't always get plenary guardianship. Sometimes it was just guardianship of their finances, or sometimes it was guardianship of their person because they were, say, living in squalor.
Joelle, thank you very much. They're from Sarasota. A lot of listener feedback here. Jay says, this whole topic is so upsetting. We have a generation of baby boomers. Some have become quite wealthy, just ripe for the picking. Who will protect them? How can they be assured the safeguards they've put in place will be honored? How can families be confident that their loved ones will be left in their care and not ripped away to live alone where family members can't even find out basic health information? I mean, Rachel, that's an important point here. Well, two points. The baby boom generation sort of ripe for the picking. But family members can be excluded from knowing a loved one is in surgery or that someone has passed away in the family. I mean, this is very broad.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I found most upsetting. There were family members who were trying to find out what was happening to, you know, often their parents. And when I spoke with a director of a nursing home that had 10 wards, she said that she felt extremely uncomfortable because she was not allowed to disclose any information about the health of these wards. So the family would say, you know, can you just tell me if he went into surgery? And she would say, no, I'm sorry. And he would say, can you just tell me if she's alive? And she, like, legally, she felt she could not tell the family member that their parent was alive or not, because that was technically medical information. I also heard stories about people would call the facility to talk to their loved one, and the director of the facility was not allowed to connect them to the patient. And eventually there was a point where only people who had a special code word given to them by the guardian could get through on the phone call to their patient, to that patient.
Mm. Pam Teaster, to listener Jay's comment there, as baby boomers increasingly age into retirement, the opportunities for abuse here grow, don't they?
Yes, Jane, because there are sheer numbers of older adults who may fall into dementia. Not all, but some will. And I wanted to comment about, take a little bit more, if I could, just a moment about Rachel's comment of people not being able to contact loved ones. good guardians, and you could find the ethics code from the National Guardianship Association online, good guardians are supposed to and do respond to let family members know things. So these would be people who aren't practicing good guardianship practices when they don't let family members know about a loved one, unless there is an issue with the family and the guardian believes that's the problem. And that's when it's in good practice. When there are bad practices, that's all different.
Rachel Aviv, what's the takeaway that you'd leave us with this hour from your extensive reporting on guardianship?
I think my takeaway, I know that the takeaway would probably be, you know, you should make sure that you have a living will and that you should be very clear about those things. I think that personally, the thing that I felt most strongly about was that the doctors and social workers should be working harder to communicate with their patients, and that there has to be a way maybe of slowing down. It just seemed that elderly people in Las Vegas were treated as consumers and as potential consumers who would bring business to their facility. And I felt that mindset was really troubling. And suddenly these people were just thrown into a world in which everything cost money and the guardian was going to tell them where to direct that money.
Last 15 seconds are yours, Pam Tiester. Your advice when it comes to guardianship?
Powers of attorney should be executed with the right persons, and attention must be paid to this issue. That is about respect for persons, and that's what really guardians are supposed to have.
Well, we've tried to do that this hour, and we appreciate you listeners for helping unveil this for us, and Rachel Aviv for your excellent reporting, staff writer for The New Yorker. Thank you very much, Rachel, for your time and your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Pam Tiester, director of the Center for Gerontology at Virginia Tech. Pam, great to have your insights. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our weekly news roundtable comes up tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.